Thanks so much for joining us today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and I'm pleased to welcome back to the studio Jennifer Cheverini. She has a new book out. It's about quilting. It's about friendship. It's about American history. Kind of typical of what she writes about here on the Ideas Network. It's always great to have her come back. And she has sharing her new book with us today. It's called The Museum of Lost Quilts. It's the latest book in the Elm Creek Quilt series. And I've had a chance to read it. Just out today, right, Jennifer?
That's right. First day of publication.
First day of publication, but I got a copy before you were able to get a copy as you're listening in here. And I want to tell you, it's a dandy book. I read most of the, I think all of the books in the Elm Creek Quilt series. And this is a nice one, a dandy. And we'll talk about the book. We'll talk maybe about quilting a little bit. We'll talk about history because there's a lot of history in this book as well. And I hope you'll join in. What does your family's quilt tell you about your personal history? Have you read Jennifer's books in the Elm Creek series or maybe some of her other books as well? Love to hear from you, too. You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Jennifer, it's always great to have you with us. And this, the Museum of Lost Quilts, which is the title, it's the latest in the series, of course, and 25 years?
Yes, that's right.
First one was written 25 years
that's
ago?
That's right. This April marks the 25th anniversary of the publication of The Quilter's Apprentice. And I didn't know it at the time, but it was the launch of the Elm Creek Quilt Series.
And we've talked about this in the past on the show. You were thinking of it as a kind of a standalone, maybe.
Yeah, that's right. When you're starting out as a young writer, which I was at the time, 25 years ago, I was given the advice: write what you know. And because I was a quilter, and I still am a quilter, and I knew about the work that goes into making a quilt. And I was fascinated by the folklore surrounding quilting in America and the wonderfully evocative quilt block and pattern names. But yeah, Most of all, I was inspired by the quilting community and the friendships that develop among quilters and the way that experienced quilters are just so generous about sharing their knowledge and with newcomers and welcoming people into that circle so that they can be a part of the arts and crafts part of it, but also a part of the friendship and the community. And I found that so appealing. And I had always wanted to be a writer ever since I learned how to read. So when I was following that advice, write what you know, I just thought, well, this is a natural subject for me to explore through fiction. Because for one thing, I wanted to write a story first for my quilting friends, mm-hmm. because I thought that they would enjoy seeing the world that they love and the people that they love and this art form that they're so passionate about. I thought they would enjoy seeing it in a realistic, contemporary way, free of some of the stereotypes that yeah. are sometimes associated with quilting. Yeah. But I also wanted to write for non-quilters so that to give them some insight into the world of quilting. So maybe they can understand their quilting friend's obsession a little bit more. And then maybe learn a little bit more about what goes into making a quilt, because it really is a fascinating art form with so many different techniques and traditions that I think maybe a lot of people aren't really aware of.
Well, I can tell you that as someone who has trouble even sewing a button on the shirt, to me, you know, quilting, I love quilts. I've got a great family quilt on my bed, and I've appreciated it. But I wondered if when I read the first book, I thought, am I going to like this book? I don't know anything about quilting, but the relationships. I mean, it's such a wonderful story. And to just say, gosh, I wish I knew these people.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I turned it from a standalone book into a series. And I always said that my books aren't about quilts. They're about quilters.
Yeah.
So really, it's always about the characters first. And as you said, their relationships, their friendships, sometimes their quarrels and disagreements. But when readers came to that first book, The Quilter's Apprentice, and I heard from them when I would go on book tour and through email and all of that, saying that they really loved these characters so much and they wanted to go back to that world. So I wrote a sequel. And then I thought I would have a book and its sequel. But then after Round Robin came out, so many people told me that they wanted to go to this quilt camp.
Yeah.
This quilting retreat in this beautiful mansion in central Pennsylvania. And they wanted to know how they could sign up for quilt camp. And then, unfortunately, I would have to tell them, I'm sorry, it's fictional. I just made it up. So I thought, okay, well, what can I do for these readers who want to go to quilt camp so badly? And I thought, well, I can't build Elm Creek Quilt Camp.
Beautiful.
However,
camp.
I wish I could.
In my mind.
If I had those resources, maybe that would be an option. But since it isn't, I thought, well, the best thing I can do as a novelist is let my readers visit Quilt Camp through the eyes of my characters. So I wrote a third book, The Cross Country Quilters, not from the viewpoint of my existing characters who run the quilt camp, but from newcomers who come and they experience what it's like to bond with friends and make new friends at a quilt camp and to focus just for a week on this craft that they love so much. And it was about when I was halfway through writing that manuscript that I realized, oh, I guess I'm writing a series. So I was a little bit slower than everybody else. And so here we are. 25 years later, and the 22nd novel coming out, and really, it's something that I have a pretty vivid imagination. You have to in my line of work, but I never could have imagined when I wrote The Quilter's Apprentice all those years ago that I would be introducing readers to the Museum of Lost Quilts all these years later. So it's really been... So I've been so much more fortunate than I could have imagined.
Well, it has been a wonderful series. What can the lovers of this series expect from the Museum of Lost Quilts?
Well, first of all, it's not going to take place in 2024. And that's something we have to clear up right away, because you might be wondering, why isn't anybody just using their smartphone? And why aren't they just Googling this? Well, the timeline for the Elm Creek Quilts novels runs at a very different pace than our own, because for one thing, it takes me 2 years to write a book, and only 3 months might transpire in the world of Elm Creek Quilts. So they're still back in 2004. So that is where this story picks up. And in this story, the youngest of the founding Elm Creek quilters, she has left quilt camp for a little while. She's gone to pursue some other ambitions. And she has been off at graduate school working on her master's degree in history. But she returns one summer. Just nobody's expecting her to show up. They all think she's going to stay back and get an early head start get to work on her PhD program.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden she shows up with quilt camp already in full swing, and they all want to know, well, what's wrong? And she's like, why can't I just come home and visit my friends? But it turns out something is very wrong. Summer has gotten a terrible case of writer's block. She has been unable to finish her thesis, and if she doesn't finish it, she can't get her degree. So she has come home to Elm Creek Manor, where she'll be surrounded by her friends, and her mom is there. She'll have this supportive community, and she's really hoping that back in this place dedicated to creativity, she'll be able to push through that writer's block, get her thesis done, and get her degree and move on. And that's her hope.
Well, I tell you, as I was reading that, I was thinking about my own experiences. I remember when I was almost finished with my PhD dissertation, I had about 2 months where I just could not finish that dissertation. It was an awful feeling.
It can't be. And and Summer's reasons for why she's blocked, you know, it's not so much that she doesn't love her subject, but she's come into another kind of conflict that she just feels like her career path forward has been blocked. And I don't want to have too many spoilers.
No.
I will say I had a master's thesis debacle of my own.
Oh, you did. And actually, you were at that University of Chicago.
I was at the University of Chicago, yes. And, you know, all of the places that Summer loves there, the libraries, the quad, all of that. I love all those places, too. There's just a little aside early in the book where Summer's friend Sarah is trying to help her figure out, well, what's causing your writer's block? And Sarah says, well, did you accidentally delete it? Because maybe you can reconstruct it. I apologize right now to my husband, who is probably listening. But when I was at the University of Chicago and I had just a month to go before graduation, I had to finish my master's thesis. My husband was using my computer. We had computers back then. It was a little Mac Classic. And I'm sorry to say that, yes, he did accidentally delete my master's thesis. However, I had printed out a lot, and I had a lot of notes. And between the two of us, one of us sleeping and the other typing, we managed to get it all entered again. And I did still marry him. He was just my boyfriend at the time. I did still marry him, and I did graduate. So yes, I certainly understand. I understand Summer's dilemma. It's not uncommon, you know.
No.
And there can be all kinds of reasons for not being able to tackle a project like this. And Summer, who has always been, you know, as one of her other friends says, the valedictorian of everything, this kind of struggle academically is something entirely new to her. So it really requires her to come back to this place where she feels safe and nurtured and loved to be able to work her way through that problem.
That's one of the story angles, and there are some more story angles that we want to talk about with our guest today, Jennifer Chavarini. Her book, The Museum of Lost Quilts, the latest in the Elm Creek Quilt Series. And you can join in, by the way. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neifert is our producer today. Jeff Robbins, our technical director. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining in today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking with our guest today, Jennifer Chavarini, about her book, The Museum of Lost Quilts. It's an Elm Creek Quilts novel. And on the 25th anniversary of the first one, and it is out today.
That's right.
Today. But since I was going to be talking with her, I got a copy ahead of time, and I really enjoyed reading it. It was so much fun for me, Jennifer. And, you know, it brings back some memories. I kept thinking, oh, I remember that. I'm sure you were consciously doing this, but bringing in from the other books in the series.
Yeah, that was one of the best things about returning to writing the Elm Creek Quilt series was that I was able to return to all of these beautiful settings that I love so much and all of these characters that I know so well and that I really care about. And I know my readers have come to think of them as friends. The most difficult part about writing book 22 all of these years later is that I really had to go back through my own books, just combing through to try to find the specific details so that I would try to maintain some continuity. You know, I didn't write down, you know, I didn't keep a master spreadsheet of where everybody lived and what their house looked like. But I want to try to get that right because I know my readers care about that sort of thing. So going back and really trying to research all the novels. But it also reminded me about conversations I've had with readers through the years about the relationships between the characters that they care so much about and the moments that have been so important to them. So I wanted to draw upon all of those in the new book. And it was also really important to me in writing this story that it would be something wonderful and familiar to people who have followed the series all the way along and want to return to that place they know so well. But I also wanted it to be welcoming to new readers who maybe haven't read the first books in the series, but they want to dive right in. And, you know, maybe they have a similar story about a thesis, and so they can relate to summer in that way. Or they are fascinated by museums and or this idea of a lost quilt. So I tried to make it so that it would also be very, very appealing to people who just want to dive in right here.
I'm wondering, you had to go through all the books again.
Most of them.
How do you feel? Do you feel your writing changed? Your writing, I mean, how did you change maybe as a writer over those years?
Oh, well, I think absolutely. I mean, I would hope that I would be a different person than I am. I'm a different person 25 years later.
Sure.
I've had 25 years of life experience, of writing books, of reading other works. It's important to see what other people are doing and what I can aspire to as a writer. And so everything that I have done and experienced in my life has changed who I am. And that, of course, is going to change what I am as a creative person. So, you know, I think if my writing's changed, if my writing style has altered through the years, I think that readers will still find that there are some essential elements of the book that are always there. And that's, you know, valuing people, cherishing friendship, showing compassion for others through my book, and always operating from a position of love and inclusion and welcoming people in. And that's something I try to practice in my life, and it's something that I hope shows up in the stories. And I think that is one of the biggest appeal, one of the strongest appeal of the novels. When I was posting on social media that I was going to have a new novel out, I was really overwhelmed by the response. And it was something I didn't anticipate. People were excited to see what the next chapter would be, but so many readers said that they missed the community.
Yeah.
And I didn't really realize that I was creating a community when I wrote this series. But that is what the experience of reading these books has been to so many people. And I really, my thought was, well, if I had known, I would have done it sooner. I would have, you know, brought back the series sooner. But it's very gratifying to me to know that the books have affected people in that way.
Yeah. Kimberly in DeForest emailed and says, hooray, with 3 exclamation points.
Oh, wonderful.
New Elm Creek Quilts book. Love, love, love the series, quilts, and historical aspects of the books.
Good, good. Yeah.
And that history part of it comes through, of course, with the you know, the Museum of Lost Quilts. Mm-hmm. That's the title, and these lost quilts.
That's right. Well, summer is studying to be a historian, of course, and I have always been fascinated by history, especially women's roles in history.
Yeah.
And it's something that infuses the Elm Creek Quilt series, I would say, as much as it does perhaps my historical standalone novels that I've written. But in this book, in the Museum of Lost Quilts, Summer, you know, as if she doesn't have enough to do, right, with finishing her master's thesis, she is asked by another Elm Creek quilter who works for the local historical society to help them with a very important fundraiser. The historic building built in 1863, and we actually see it being built in The Union Quilters, yeah. another Elm Creek Quilts novel, one of the historical novels in the series. It has really fallen into disrepair. And in order to save it from being, you know, demolished and, you know, deemed a local hazard, so it has to be torn down, the Historical Society is launching a capital campaign to raise all the money that they'll need to refurbish this building. And Agnes, who's both an Elm Creek quilter and a member of the Historical Society, thinks that the perfect way to launch this capital campaign is with an exhibit in the newly remodeled East Gallery of the building. And it's going to be a quilt exhibit, but it's not just any quilts. Mm. They need to be of quilts with some kind of important significance to local history. Mm-hmm. So whether because it was made by a famous member of this community, or if it captured some important historical event, something that has an important tie. So Summer takes on the role of tracking down important quilts with historical significance locally and learning about who made them, where they came from, what was that role in history, and then preparing them for exhibit, which sometimes means a lot of, you know, cleaning, gentle cleaning, and, you know, taking care of maybe some mending. Yeah. Nothing that would diminish the historical value, of course. And then writing descriptions of the quilts to be displayed alongside them in the gallery. So Summer, you know, she doesn't really want to be working on her thesis, so this offers her a nice diversion. You know.
Perfect excuse not to have to work on.
Right. But, you know, she's like, okay, if I get a page done of my thesis, then I can reward myself with this quilting work. So it helps encourage her, and it also gets her creativity moving again. Because she's been so stymied with this type of writing, she really needs to go and kind of replenish herself with a different kind of creativity. And that helps unlock this, you know, this knot of stress and worry that has been preventing her from finishing this other project.
And I love how you end the chapters, those chapters about the quilt, each quilt, with the description that she has apparently written.
Right.
About the history of the quilt.
Right. And they're written like the sort of description that you would see on a museum wall. And I think not only does that give the reader an image of the quilt, but it also tells us about Summer, because she's making choices about what to include when she's describing the history of the quilt and what needs to, you know, it's a really interesting story, but it needs to stay out. And so it gives us some insight into what Summer thinks is important.
Yeah.
What stories Summer thinks need to be told, even if maybe other people don't want them to be told.
Yeah. And that, you know, I have a friend, a really good friend, who is a realtor, and she's a very principled person. And you have a realtor in the story, and I think he's appeared before.
Yes, he's been Sarah's nemesis from the very first book. So I talk about bringing back the characters I love. I also have to bring back the ones people love to hate.
Oh my goodness! Well. And there's even a romantic interest as well.
Yeah, so. There's a little nice light romance. Yeah, so as if Summer needs another distraction, right?
So I want to. You mentioned in passing some of the other books that you wrote after you finished. You thought you were finished.
I thought I was.
You finished the Elm Creek Quilt series, and I loved all. I think we talked about almost all of those books. I had you in for Canary Girls, Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker, Resistance Women. Mm-hmm. I think that was about
Mildred Fish Harnack.
Yes. Harnack, yeah.
Yes, from a Wisconsin native.
And switchboard
soldiers, right?
Soldiers. Well, many.
Yeah,
Canary Girls. Yeah.
We've chatted about them all, but there are a lot.
There were some bestsellers, New York Times bestsellers among those books, more than one. Was it more difficult writing these standalone pieces, which I loved them all, and all had to do with history and either an individual woman or many women working together,
mm-hmm.
Which I found really interesting and fascinating because I learned something in every single one of those books that I didn't know before. So thank you for writing those. Were those books more difficult to write for you? Or?
Well, the historical standalone novels do require a lot of research up front before I begin drafting the first draft of the manuscript. So there is that time investment, but I really love doing the historical research, so that's time I'm very happy to spend. So, I really like to delve into the archives at the Wisconsin Historical Society and all kinds of other wonderful libraries. I also like to look at historical newspapers to find out information that my characters would have been learning at the time. So in some ways it's more challenging because of all that research that I need to do up front. But I also do a lot of that kind of historical research for novels in the Elm Creek Quilt series. So it was something, and of course my own graduate school experience is something that I'm accustomed to and I really enjoy doing. So perhaps it puts more time into the project, but I don't know that it necessarily changes the degree of difficulty.
Yeah, I thought it would probably be just as hard to write. You weave together so many different women and quilts from history. What can quilts tell us about American history?
Well, quilts have always formed an important part of women discussing ideas and women exchanging information. So, because this was a place where women could gather, even if you were out in the countryside, people might all come together for a quilting bee. So quilting bees were always a place where women spoke and where women connected and shared ideas, whether it was advice that they learned from running their own household or to political or social ideas that were transforming their lives as women, or they hoped would be transforming their lives as women. So places where women could gather and speak freely formed such an important basis for so many of our social movements, like so much discussion of the suffrage movement would take place at a meeting like this in the very, very early days. And then often quilts were made as symbols of protest or to convey a message. It is a form of artistic expression. It was something that women were able to do. I mean, they might not have been encouraged to take up oil painting or sculpting, but since quilting was considered a domestic art, it was a medium that women could express themselves in. So it also had an important role in women's development as artists. And we see that today, with the development of the AIDS quilt, for example.
Yeah.
And that wasn't just women, of course. It was a broader community. But quilts played an important role in expressing protest and grieving over in that period of American history. And then there's an organization now called the Social Justice Sewing Academy that encourages people to make quilts to express their concerns, their outrage, their hopes about various issues going on in society today. So quilting has been there all along, whether it's naming a particular quilt pattern about a political figure who fought for abolition back in the 1800s, or someone making a quilt to express their concerns about a social issue today. Quilting has always been there as a form of artistic expression for everyone, not only women, but especially in those early years, that was a form that women were able to use.
I was thinking about one of the quilts. I have kind of a Civil War buff and read lots of books about the Civil War, but one of the books one of the quilts you feature in the novel is the, is it Garrard or Girard Log Cabin?
The log cabin.
It was sewn during the Civil War.
Right. Well, there is a, these were the kind of stories and folklore that so fascinated me when I was deciding to write about the quilters and their community. There's folklore surrounding the log cabin pattern.
Log cabin block. Sorry.
It is a quilt pattern that has a central square and then alternating rectangles of light and dark are sewn to it to create in a concentric fashion. So the log cabin block, according to folklore, you're supposed to have a red center square in order to represent the hearth, or a yellow center square to represent a light in the log cabin window. And there is folklore that says log cabin quilts that had a black center square were signal quilts on the Underground Railroad, showing that this particular house that had this quilt displayed there was a station on the Underground Railroad. And like everyone else who heard this story, I found it absolutely fascinating. Yeah. And like so many others, I was really crushed when I found out that it was only a myth.
Oh,
I know, but it was such a wonderful story. So I included it in one of my books, and I've mentioned it in a few others too, to explore, well, if this is folklore, how might this story have come about? Because I find that fascinating, mm-hmm. too. You know, it's quilt historians like Barbara Brackman and others have really delved into this, and they have conclusively argued, from my evaluation of what they've written. As far as I'm concerned, it's conclusive. I trust them. They cite their sources, and I trust them. The story isn't true, but what inspired this folklore, and why was it so enduring? You know, so that's something that I wanted to explore in some of my novels, and having my characters go through that same process of, oh wow, I hope this is true, and oh, it's not, but it's still such a great story, and I think it really shows how quilts, which are common to so many households. Yeah. You know, so many of us have a memory of a favorite quilt that we had from childhood, or that we received as a wedding gift, or that we saw our great-grandmother making. So it really speaks to us of home and family and tradition and, you know, nostalgia for the past. So I really think the kind of stories like the log cabin quilt block, it really speaks to that appeal that quilts have for us and how they captivate our imagination, even if we don't know which end of the needle to thread and couldn't make one ourselves, they still have that appeal for us.
Well, it appealed to me, and it does turn up in the book. You do have reference to that in the book. You also have reference to... was it Victory Quilts?
Yes, Victory Quilts, right. That shows up. There are two Victory Quilts in particular that Summer is searching for to include in the museum exhibit. And these were quilts that were made, and it didn't have to be, unlike, you know, the log cabin block is a very specific quilt pattern with lots of variations. But Victory Quilts, that's a name used for any quilt, and they were often made during World War II,
Yeah.
It just like you've heard of Victory Gardens and Victory Bonds. But these were quilts that were made as fundraisers, often in a raffle, to raise money for various causes to support the war effort or to support veterans or their widows and children. And so in Sylvia's case, when she was in her 20s living in Waterford, Pennsylvania, her quilt guild used the grandmother's flower garden quilt pattern, which is a pattern of hexagons seamed together in concentric fashions. And in the center of each, the center hexagon was embroidered with the name of a serviceman from their local area who was off fighting in the Pacific or fighting in Europe. And the plan was to include the names of all of the local young men and to raffle it off to raise money to support the war effort. But as Summer is looking for the quilt that Sylvia worked on all those decades ago, and she's trying to track that down, you know, who won the raffle? Do they still live in the area? Might they still have the quilt in their possession? And if so, can Summer convince them to lend it to the exhibit? She discovers that a neighboring town also had a Victory quilt of their own. And that propels Summer into a mystery of why didn't they all work together on the same quilt? Why were there two different quilts? Why were some men from this young men from the area in one quilt and not the other? And then that's something that that Summer uncovers, and in the process discovers maybe some aspects of her hometown's past that aren't that don't necessarily put it in the best light. And then she has a choice to make. Does she expose the secrets that she's learned? And if so, why? And how much does she tell? And will it hurt people? Is it important to tell unhappy stories from our community's past, even if it causes people pain or discomfort or embarrassment? And these are all questions that Summer, as an aspiring historian, really needs to grapple with.
And if you pick up a copy of Jennifer Cheverini's book, The Museum of Lost Quilts, you will learn how that came out.
That's right.
Oh, it's so much fun to talk with you. You've got a book tour.
Yes, I do.
Tell us what's coming up in the near future.
Well, today I will be at Mystery to Me in Madison. And then tomorrow, Wednesday, I'll be out at the Cedarburg Public Library.
Oh, what time?
Now that is a detail. I can tell you all kinds of historical dates, but where I will be tomorrow, I think it's at 6 or 6:30. But best of all,
Cedarburg.
All of this will be on my website. On the events page, it's jennifercheverini.com. And then you'll also see links, because some of the events do require registration ahead of time so in case they run out of room. But also in Wisconsin, I'll be in Eau Claire. Later in the month, I'll be in some places in northern Illinois. I'm making a trip out to Iowa and Indiana. But mostly staying here in the Midwest. And all of the dates and locations are up there on my website.
Well, and I know you have another book coming after this one.
I do. A year from now. Right now, it's scheduled to come out on April Fool's Day. Which I think is pretty fun. It's called The World's Fair Quilt. And in this, it's a dual timeline story. So we have Sylvia in, you know, what for her is the modern day, 2004. And it also flashes back to 1933, when she and her sister collaborated on a quilt to enter in the Sears National Quilt Competition for the Chicago World's Fair, which for the Century of Progress Exposition. And this was at the time, this was a real quilt competition, and it was at the time the largest quilt contest ever held, and it remains so even today, even to this day. So we'll have another historical story, but it'll also include all of the Elm Creek quilters that my readers I know we'll want to spend more time with.
And we'll have you back to talk about that, Jennifer.
Sounds
thank
great.
You, thank you so much. The Museum of Lost Quilts is the title. And your website,
JenniferSheverini.com.
She'll be back and we will talk with her again. Always a treat for me to visit with her. And I bet it was a treat for you as well. And take a look at her new and latest book. And just to keep going here, we've got some things to do in spring in Wisconsin. You know, this place, this state, there are more festivals and more events going on throughout the year, but particularly spring and summer. And we'll be talking about those upcoming events with Ann Sayers from the Wisconsin Department of Tourism next. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're looking for a list of things to do this spring, you've come to the right place. We've got everything from waterfalls to fine dining on the show today. Larry Mueller here, talking about events and activities that'll help you welcome springtime. And our guest Ann Sayers back with us once again, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. Ann began that role in 2021 after serving as acting secretary since December of 2020 and deputy secretary since 2019. So great to have her back with us. And I hope you'll join in as we move along today. Tell us your favorite waterfall to visit or a spring festival that might be going on in your area or maybe one you are planning to attend. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Secretary Ann Sayers, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me. I always love to be here. Good to hear you, Larry.
Well, I tell you what, some of your people told me that we were going to start out with something new and fun today, and it's a game called Fest or Fiction. But before we, and you're going to test me, I guess, I've heard, and probably make me look foolish, but we'll see. Tell us about this new challenge from Travel Wisconsin and where that idea came from.
Well, I'm so glad you're willing to play along. This is going to be a lot of fun, and you will not look silly because Wisconsin has so many festivals, and a lot of them are just kind of inconceivable or borderline unbelievable. So that's why the game is so much fun. And I'm still getting them wrong. I still play on travelwisconsin.com/fest or fiction, and I still get things wrong. So it's partly to educate folks about everything that's out there, but also just to have some fun and celebrate all the ways that Wisconsin finds to celebrate our unique traditions.
So you have a list of what does it look like? I purposely didn't go on because I thought, well, that'd be cheating.
Okay, well, this will be good. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say the name of a festival, and you have to guess if it's real or it's fiction. Is it a fest or is it fiction? And then if it's real, I'll give you the details so folks can go check it out sometime. And if it's made up, I'll share details about a similar sounding event.
Okay. All right. I guess I'm ready.
Okay. First up, beer and ballet. Is it a fest or is it fiction?
Beer and ballet. I know a lot of beer festivals, and there may be some ballet festivals, but I don't think there's a beer and ballet festival. Oh, no. There is?
I'm sorry, Larry. You're off to a rough start here this morning. It is a fest. So you can... It's okay. You'll get more tries. But let me tell you a little more about this
ballet.
Yeah, it's the finale event of the Green Bay Ballet Festival. It's coming up Saturday, May 4th. It's a wonderful performance by top professional dancers from around the nation. It takes place at the Widener, which you know is a spectacular performing arts venue. It's a family-friendly program. It features artists returning to Green Bay to give back to the community through the arts. In addition to ballet being performed by to some of the greatest scores like Tchaikovsky, visitors can expect short dance films and beer tastings from local breweries, and that even includes root beer.
Oh, okay. Well, I do know that there are some very good breweries, local breweries in the Green Bay area, and I have sampled some of those, so at least... I haven't
That's
been to a ballet there, but I've sampled the beer, so I
You're doing it right.
All right, well, lay another one on me.
Okay, next up, Blueberry Bonanza, best or fiction?
Blueberry Bonanza. We have a lot of... I would have heard of a blueberry festival. I'm going to say no. I got one right.
Nice. Excellent. Good instinct.
There should be a blueberry festival.
Well, right. That's what I was thinking. But you don't have to get blue because we do have something similar, and that is Cedarburg's Strawberry Festival. And that annual event kicks off this summer in a very sweet way. You can celebrate the strawberry the weekend of June 22nd and 23rd with tasty treats. Of course, they've got strawberry shortcake, strawberry wine, and everything else. You can enjoy strolling the streets of beautiful Cedarburg. There's food vendors and unique shopping, live music. It's a family-friendly festival. It has some fun-filled contests and activities for the kids and other entertainment.
Well, I love Cedarburg. That's for sure. It is a really cool place to visit. So... Well, I got one right anyway.
One for two.
One for two. All right. Well, what do we got next?
Okay. Next up, the Wisconsin Two-Step Showdown. Fest or fiction?
Well, this is a two-step state for sure. Are you a two-step dancer?
I can pretend to be. Are you?
Oh, yeah. That was my mother and dad were great dancers, and that was just one of, but is there a festival? I'm going to say no. Oh, I was right again.
Nice. Excellent. So there is not a Wisconsin two-step showdown, but there is a Wisconsin State Polka Festival. And this year, the festival is celebrating its 45th anniversary. You can travel to Washington County the weekend of May 17th through the 19th for tons of fun honoring our official state dance, the polka. At Sterling Chalet in Hubertus, you'll bounce about the dance floors as live polka bands fill the hall with music. And if you don't know the steps to polka, that might apply to me, actually, you can show up on Saturday, May 18th to receive lessons in the dance style. And that's where you're going to discover that whole spirit of Gemütlichkeit at the Wisconsin State Polka Festival.
I love the hot polka. I love the hot polka. There's different types. I can do the regular polkas, but I can also, I've got a friend that I will do the hot polka together. I can remember doing it at the German restaurant at Disney World and had a whole bunch of people watch us do it.
I bet they were so impressed.
Well,
like this guy's from Wisconsin.
If you'd have said the polka festival, I would have known that for sure was one. All right. So that's three. And what did I get? Two right so far?
Two for three. And this is your last one.
All right.
Here it is. The 100-mile garage sale. Best or fiction?
100-mile garage sale. Where would you have a 100-mile garage sale? I don't know. It could be. I suppose there could be one. But I'm going to say no. You know what I'm thinking now? Is it along? Is it along a river?
It is. Yes.
That's okay. I couldn't figure. Well, that I'm just came to my head.
Half credit for that.
Oh, okay. Well, where? Well, it's 100 miles long. So, which river?
It is. Well, it's happening along the Great River Road, and it is happening this weekend. The 100-mile garage sale. You can head to the gorgeous western border of our state along the Mississippi River. Oh. It's actually. It's so cool. It's communities on both sides of the state who participate in the event. So in Wisconsin, communities like Alma, Nelson, Pepin, Stockholm, Maiden Rock, and Bay City, you can tool around there. You can discover treasures, trinkets, all sorts of goods. And there's these distinctive colored ribbons that make it easy for you to identify the participating garage sales. And that 100-mile garage sale takes place from Thursday through Sunday. And I told you, some of these are really inconceivable, but they're real.
Well, I'm glad at least I got, I mean, I couldn't figure out where, it had to be along a river. It had to be along a river. Well, I tell you what, I didn't do great, but I got a couple right. Ann Sayers is going to be with us right up until 12:30, and we'll have lots more to talk about events going around our state. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with Ann Sayers. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for staying with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller with my guest, Ann Sayers. Ann is Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism, having some fun with her today as we talk about spring festivals going on around the state and why maybe you should consider attending. And maybe you have an event going on in your area that you want to let people know about as well. Give us a call. Questions or maybe is something to share? Number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Well, I like that fest or fiction. And how to, and already people are saying, where did that come from? How do you locate that? And I promise I'm not going to go to it right away.
You can go to travelwisconsin.com/fest or fiction. It's true. You'll lose some time over there. It's a lot of fun.
All right. Well, it's also hiking's a lot of fun. I enjoy hiking. And as the weather warms, you might hit the hiking trails. You've got a resource on your webpage called Wisconsin Trail Report. What can we find out there?
Yeah, this is a really cool thing. It's a comprehensive tool for planning your outdoor adventures, whether you're hiking or you're biking. It's an interactive map, and it's going to help you find trail networks. The report includes trail networks at, you know, state parks, county and municipal parks. It even has private and nonprofit organizations like Nature Center. So it's kind of a one-stop shop there. It has more than 175 trail networks where you can find outdoor fun, but it makes planning your trip really easy. It's going to tell you some nearby recommendations for activities, events, restaurants, lodging. It even has a four-day weather forecast. So everything you need, plus it has the trail condition. And that's the really, like, the special thing about this, where it'll tell you whether it's in good, fair, poor, or sometimes closed. It's updated regularly by volunteers throughout the state. And we're going to keep that going through late fall, which, as folks know, you can then turn to the fall color report. We'll be live then. But until then, you can find the travelwisconsin.com, the report at travelwisconsin.com/trail report. Sorry. I'm very excited.
Well, I understand. And you've got, we have a few parks with hiking trails that you'd like to kind of recommend. The first is Pottawatomie State Park in Door County, though. And I've been on that trail, on those trails.
There's just so many. But I thought this was a fun one to start with because it's the very beginning of the 1,000-mile-long Ice Age Trail. So it's in Door County. The Pottawatomie State Park is home to that eastern terminus. It zigzags its way throughout Wisconsin following the edge of the last glacier. But you can hike those first 3 miles of the Ice Age Trail until you hit the park's edge. And if you don't want to tackle the remaining 997 miles of the Ice Age Trail, you can turn back and go to the Tower Trail that's part of Pottawatomie State Park. That path loops through the property. There's beautiful views there from the highest bluff in the park. So, and another idea, actually, while you're up there, you've got to check, if you haven't already, check out Eagle Tower. That's in Peninsula State Park. That's a 60-foot tall observation tower. It's fully accessible. It just opened for the season now. It's a 850-foot long ramp. Just incredible. It leads visitors up through the canopy to the top of the tower, and you can catch sweeping views of Lake Michigan's Green Bay from up there. It's very special amenity.
I love that, Ray. I love that that whole thing. In the past, you know, you'd have to climb the steps that, you know, kind of straight up the tower, and I did it. But this is more fun.
It's more fun and it's more accessible. It just means more people can get a chance to see Wisconsin from that perspective.
Yeah. Wyalusing State Park in Grand County?
Yes. So that is Wisconsin's western border. The state park sits 500 feet above the confluence of the Mississippi and the Wisconsin rivers. From on top of the river bluffs, you're going to soak up uninterrupted views for miles. They have 14 miles of hiking trails you can choose from, all different levels of difficulty. Cool. One of the more challenging ones is the Old Immigrant Trail, where you get to trek through this wooded hillside on a narrow path, and it's lined with rock outcroppings. I haven't done that one yet, but it sounds very cool, a little challenging.
That does sound challenging. I haven't been on that one. Geneva Lakeshore Path in Walworth County
This is another gem in Wisconsin, a totally different kind of hiking opportunity where you can take in the grandeur of Lake Geneva by hiking along that whole Geneva Lakeshore path. The famed path allows hikers to literally, you're walking through the backyards of these striking century-old mansions. Yeah. The entire lake is surrounded by the path. It's 26 miles total. It's maintained by each of the property owners. And it's kind of fun as you go through it because you can see how they all have maintained it differently. So some paths are gravel or cement, some are stepping stones or grass. That's going to vary throughout your trip. It would take, I mean, they say 8 to 10 hours to complete. It would probably take me 24 hours. But so you could just do it in segments. You can just hike parts of it and make a plan to come back and do more of it. I mean, you're going to want to build in other things to do in Lake Geneva while you're there, of course.
Well, I think that we are going to have to update your fest questions because a listener called and couldn't stay with us. They want us to know that there's an Iron River Lions Blueberry Festival.
Okay.
It's in July.
Iron River Blueberry Festival in July. Great.
And so you can get your, we can all get our blueberry fix there. So we'll have to check and make sure that's on the page. Clara thought it was on the page. But anyway, there is a blueberry festival, which is really good to know. Well, you know what else is good to know? The waterfalls that we have in the state. There are a lot of waterfalls. They're you know, popular in springtime. Usually there's more water flowing. And there are some to visit in Sauk County.
Some of my favorite ones. Sauk County, you know, they're dotted with bluffs, hills, valleys, these deep gorges, and that's just the perfect place to discover a waterfall tucked away. And one of them to check out for sure is Parfrees Glen. This is a spectacular gorge. It was Wisconsin's first state natural area. And one of those places where you can just sort of feel the heat of the day drop away as you trek through that shady ravine. And then you're marveling there at the sandstone cliffs towering above you. And at the end of it all is this calming waterfall. So just so worth the trip. Another one while you're in Sauk County is Pewitt's Nest. That was carved into the rock during the retreat of the last glacier. And for this one, you wander your way through a narrow 40-foot deep canyon. And at the end, you find this small waterfall. And Also, you can visit Lake Redstone County Park. That's near Reedsburg, kind of in the neighborhood too. And that's actually a spillway that formed a large artificial waterfall, but still cool and refreshing on a summer or spring day.
Yeah. Hayman Falls Park in Shawnee County.
Yes, so this has
some rushing water there.
Yes, it's a perfect example of all those little drops adding up to a big splash. They have a series of rapids. It's the Embarrass River there in Shawnee County. It's a picturesque backdrop for your spring adventures. The park features a trail to hike alongside the river. There's picnic tables. There's grills you can hang out at. There's horseshoe pits. There's an informal diamond. So just a great place to bring the family and spend some time. And if you are looking for nearby food and drinks, you could head over to Stubborn Brothers Brewery. That's in downtown Shawnee, and they have stubbornly good brews and excellent food, including, of course, Wisconsin. A Friday fish fry, usually always featuring locally caught Great Lakes fish.
And finally, you wanted to talk about Weekweewak?
Excellent. Yes, I think that's right.
In Green Bay.
Yes. So, this season is your best chance probably to catch that curtain of water that cascades into a large ravine forming the Weekweewak Falls. During the summer months, it can dry up or it can at least slow down, so now's the time to go. At Weekweewak, you'll also get a close-up look at the Niagara Escarpment. So this is that unique geological formation that starts in Wisconsin, it extends into the UP, and then runs through Canada to Niagara Falls. And when you're in Green Bay, if you haven't done this one, the Booyah Shed.
So
the signature food here is the Booyah Stew. It's cooked in a 45-gallon cast iron kettle, and they use a mix of green and yellow beans, of course, a nod to our Packers. And you can order it from anywhere from a cup to four quarts, depending on how hungry. I just love it.
Depending on how hungry you are, or you want to take some home.
Yeah, that's probably a better idea.
I think that's probably a whole lot better idea. Oh my gosh. Let's turn from the water to, water's kind of, the falls are artistic in their own way, but there are a few places for what we call or what is called experimental art in Wisconsin. It does sound intriguing. What is experimental art?
Well, I mean, this is just a way for, and we hear this a lot, that travelers are looking for ways to kind of get hands-on and try some things. And I always say, I'm not artistic, but then I was looking at this list, and I was like, well, I've never tried stained glass. Maybe I'm brilliant. Who knows? So we have a couple ideas for you to get out there and just get experiential, get experimental, and see what you can produce.
Oh, I love it. We just had James sent us an email, by the way. This is off the art track. Well, maybe not in a way, but there's a rib fest in Elkhorn that is always a great time. Free admission, of course, parking and live entertainment. But I don't have, it's a summer festival, rib fest.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun.
Well, it's an Elkhorn, so there you go. I love ribs, so that would be one I'd want to look for. Well, back to experimental art. What would it be a good idea to maybe take children to experimental art galleries?
Yeah, absolutely. One idea for you is in Kenosha County. It's the Lemon Street Gallery. It's a visual arts organization at Kenosha. They've been educating the public since 1999, and they have a bunch of classes and lots of different mediums. So a great option for visitors is this stained glass option. There's several classes available weekends in May. And over 2 hours, you get to design a small sun catcher, cut and grind the glass pieces, solder them together, and then you have this really fun souvenir you get to take home with you. So I just think that would be a really fun thing to try, you know?
Yeah, and with kids, I mean, why not? Mm-hmm. That'd be a wonderful thing. And Shake Rag Alley in Iowa County, an interesting name. Do you know any of the history of Shake Rag Alley?
I don't, actually. I wonder if any callers might.
But it's got an interesting history. And I love going there. The buildings and so forth that are so old and lots of art places that sell that are selling art made by local art folks there. A lot of fun.
Yeah, I think Middle Point is a place where you get inspired because it's such a great community. And the idea that you can go to Shake Rag Alley and get trained on a few things. They offer workshops for adults. They have half-day classes, multi-day. They even have some in-depth retreats. So find what suits you. But you can learn from talented local artists plus nationally known creatives. You can sign up for workshops covering, I mean, really all the mediums. They have rug making, basket weaving, they have mosaic making, blacksmithing, all the things. And you can stay, of course, while you're there. I mean, wouldn't this be great? A night at the Mineral Point Hotel. It's just a historic property, charming guest rooms, the heart of downtown. Just a perfect Wisconsin weekend getaway.
So that's Shake Rag Alley at long about Christmas time, just before Christmas, and went to purchase some gifts there, and it was so much fun going up and down the store, down the street with the stores, and then you sort of to top it off near the end, we're all out in the street, and there go some wonderful local fireworks. It was a great memories sitting there drinking some hot chocolate and watching the fireworks right in the middle of the street.
Mary, we're in a Hallmark movie. That's what you just described.
that's what it felt like. It was absolutely wonderful experience. Oh man. Well, the TV show Top Chef is featuring Wisconsin this year. And there are, first, I think that had to be great from a tourism, maybe not right immediately, but for advertising, could we even find anything better?
It's just amazing. 14 episodes, 75 minutes long, all based in Wisconsin. And we're getting to tell these stories of our culinary heritage. So while it was filmed mostly in Milwaukee and Madison, we're getting to hear about ginseng and cranberries and fish fries and supper clubs and all the things that make us so special. So we are just thrilled that Bravo's Top Chef chose Wisconsin for season 21. It's been wonderful.
Plenty of unique restaurants in our state. I know you wanted to mention a couple. One, the Glarnerstube in Greene County.
Yeah, it's a New Glarus restaurant, and they have that traditional Swiss fare. It's a really great example of some of our immigration families that came in and sort of made their cuisine known, and now it's just this local favorite, the Glarnerstube. You need to start your meal off with the cheese fondue. It is a bubbling Swiss cheese flavor with wine and garlic served with bread. I feel like there's nothing in this world I want more.
And it's lunchtime right now, as a matter of fact. I could use something right now.
Well, so good.
The Union House in Waukesha County, that one's been around for a long time. More like a supper club, isn't it?
It's so lovely. Fine dining restaurant. You're going to love just a memorable experience, warm hospitality, unique menu. And they build it just in response to whatever is fresh all through the year. They have appetizers, desserts, dishes incorporate high quality ingredients. It's all just kind of impressive and elevated. One of the things they're known for is their wild game feature. It's a seasonally inspired dish. It fuses wild game with fine dining. And then they also have a fabulous wine and scotch selection from around the world.
So a wonderful place. Judith in Milwaukee emailed us with an event that's an empanadas. I'm pronouncing that right. Am I not? Empanadas night at Gallery 218 in Milwaukee, where you get sample a variety of meat and vegetarian empanadas, regular and non-alcoholic sangria by El Gaucho Grill at Gallery 218. And that's on June 12th. From 5 to 8, and you can also view an art exhibit titled An Abstract Nature by Wisconsin Artists. Tickets are required for that one, but that sounds like fun. It's June 12th from 5 to 8. Tickets are about $30 or thereabouts. So
fantastic. Thank you for that suggestion. That sounds like a great time. Food and art.
So,
love it.
Yeah, and Milwaukee Is it the festival capital of Wisconsin?
Yes, the city of festivals.
I don't know how many festivals there are. And part of it, I think, relates to the various ethnic groups that reside in Milwaukee and the area.
That's true of Milwaukee, and really it's true of the whole state. We have so many different backgrounds represented in our state, and it's so neat that they want to bring that celebration forward, invite the whole community to be a part of it, and we see it everywhere. It's really fun.
So what are you going to do this weekend? Are you off to, what do you do as you are, it's got to be for you, it's got to be fun, I guess, but it's got to be kind of a busy job. I mean, you've got to manage the operation, but you also have to get out there.
Oh, you're so right. This weekend, I'm actually off to LA to pitch Wisconsin to national and international tour operators, make sure we get some more tourists coming to Wisconsin. But in recent weeks, I've been everywhere. I've had a great time. I spent a little more time at Taliesin. I love every time I get a chance to be in the home of Frank Lloyd Wright or his studio, his theater. I'm so inspired. I actually took my family, including my dogs, to Stevens Point for a little weekend getaway, and that was perfect with the puppies. It was a great location to travel with them. We had an enormous ice cream bigger than our head at Belts. That was so fun. A couple weekends ago, I headed to Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay. Oh my gosh, that is just an incredible gem of our state. If you haven't had a chance to see it, home of the largest refracting telescope. Everyone studied there, Hubble and Carl Sagan, Einstein visited, and you can see why when you have a chance to be there.
Jennifer emailed us to help us out on Shake Rag Alley. It's called Shake Rag Alley because miners' wives used to signal them with pieces of cloth to let them know their food was ready. So Shake Rag. And of course, that's where the miners... there's a lot of mining going on in that part of the state way back in the day. So that's where Shake Rag Alley comes from. And by the way, Jennifer says, Ann Sayers is the best guest ever. She makes me love Wisconsin. What do you think of that?
Jennifer's best caller ever.
Oh, my goodness me. Well, you know, and it's always fun to have you come. You know, the next time you come, we ought to try that test again. You can come up with some. Yeah, I promise I won't look. I will not study. I mean, I will just rely on my own. I have been to so many festivals in my lifetime in Wisconsin. There's got to be a few that are going to just pop up by accident on that festival contest.
And knowing Wisconsin, we're going to make up about 50 more between now and then. So okay. Keep us on our toes.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks a lot. Ann Sayers, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. And she'll be back and we'll do this again. By the way, don't forget we have that exciting match for in honor of World Press Day. Your donation, any amount up to $30,000, will be matched by generous donors at WPR. You can give now at wpr.org/donate or phone 888-202-2552. Thanks so much for listening, but hey, stay with us. Lots more in store on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller.